Chapter 4. Space-time. In the previous chapters, we followed the historical road to relativity, and in fact our reasoning was not too far from what Einstein originally presented. We have been forced to accept that space is not the great stage upon which the events of our lives are played out. Likewise, time is not something universal and absolute. Instead, we move toward a picture of space and time that is much more malleable and subjective. The great clock in the sky, and in some sense the sky itself, has been banished. It might feel to us like the world is a box within which we go about our business, because that picture allows us to make sense of it quickly and efficiently. The ability to map the movement of things against an imaginary grid is what we might call spatial awareness, and it is clearly important if you are to avoid predators, catch food, and survive in a dangerous and challenging environment. But there is no reason why this model, buried deep within our brains and reinforced over millions of years by natural selection, should be anything other than a model. If a way of thinking about the world confers a survival advantage, then that way of thinking will become ubiquitous. The scientific correctness of it is irrelevant. The important thing is that because we chose to accept the results of experiments conducted on Faraday's mottled benchtop and the explanations codified by Maxwell, we have acted like scientists and rejected the comfortable model of space and time that allowed our ancestors to survive and prosper on the ancient plains of Africa. This model has been embedded and reinforced deep within our psyche by our experiences over many millions of years, and discarding it may well be disorientating. That dizzying feeling of confusion, if, hopefully, followed by an epiphany of clarity, is the joy of science. If the listener is feeling the former, we hope to deliver the latter by the end of the book. This is not a history book. Our aim is to describe space and time in the most enlightening way we can, and it is our view that the historical road to relativity does not necessarily provide the best path to enlightenment. From a modern perspective, over a century after Einstein's revolution, we have learned that there is a deeper and more satisfying way to think about space and time. Rather than dig any deeper into the old-fashioned textbook view, we are going to start again from a blank canvas. In so doing, we will come to understand what Minkowski meant when he said that space and time must be merged together into a single entity. Once we have developed a more elegant picture, we will be well placed to achieve our principal goal. We shall be able to derive E equals mc squared. Here is the starting point. Einstein's theories can be constructed almost entirely using the language of geometry. That is, you don't need much algebra, just pictures and concepts. At the heart of the matter, there lie only three concepts: invariance, causality, and distance. Unless you are a physicist, two of these will probably be unfamiliar words, and the third familiar, but, as we shall see, subtle. Invariance is a concept that lies at the core of modern physics. Glance out at the world now, then turn around and look in the opposite direction. Your room will look different from different vantage points, of course, but the laws of nature are the same. It doesn't matter whether you are pointing north, south, east, or west, gravity still has the same strength and still keeps your feet on the ground. Your TV still works when you spin it around, and your car still starts whether you've left it in London, Los Angeles, or Tokyo. These are all examples of invariance in nature. When put like this, invariance seems like little more than a statement of the obvious. But imposing the requirement of invariance on our scientific theories proves to be an astonishingly fruitful thing to do. We have just described two different forms of invariance. The requirement that the laws of nature will not change if we spin around and determine them while facing different directions is called rotational invariance. The requirement that the laws will not change if we move from place to place is called translational invariance. These seemingly trivial requirements turned out to be astonishingly powerful in the hands of Emmy Noether, whom Albert Einstein described as the most important woman in the history of mathematics. In 1918, Noether published a theorem that revealed a deep connection between invariance and the conservation of particular physical quantities. We will have more to say about conservation laws in physics later on. But for now, let us just state the deep result Noether discovered. For the specific example of looking at the world in different directions, if the laws of nature remain unchanged, irrespective of the direction in which we are facing, then there exists a quantity that is conserved. In this case, the conserved quantity is called angular momentum. For the case of translational invariance, the quantity is called momentum. Why should this be important? Let's pull an interesting physics fact out of the metaphorical hat and explain it. The moon moves 4 centimeters farther away from the Earth every year. Why? Picture the moon in your mind's eye as being stationary above the surface of the spinning Earth. The water in the oceans directly beneath the moon will bulge out a tiny bit towards the moon because the moon's gravity is pulling it, and the Earth will rotate once a day beneath this bulge. This is the cause of the ocean tides. There is friction between the water and the surface of the Earth, and this friction causes the Earth's rate of spin to slow down. The effect is tiny but measurable. The Earth's day is gradually lengthening by approximately 2/1000th of a second per century. Physicists measure the rate of spin using angular momentum, so we can say that the angular momentum of the Earth is reducing over time. Noether tells us that because the world looks the same in every direction, to be more precise, the laws of nature are invariant under rotations, then angular momentum is conserved, which means that the total amount of spin must not change. So what happens to the angular momentum the Earth loses by tidal friction? The answer is that it is transferred to the moon, which speeds up in its orbit around the Earth to compensate for the slowing down of the Earth's rotation. This causes it to drift slightly farther away from the Earth. In other words, to ensure that the total angular momentum of the Earth and Moon system is conserved, the Moon must drift into a wider orbit around the Earth to compensate for the fact that the Earth's rate of spin is slowing down. This is a very real and quite fantastic effect. The Moon is big, and it is drifting farther away from the Earth as every year goes by to conserve angular momentum. Italian novelist Italo Calvino found it so wonderful that he wrote a short story called The Distance of the Moon, in which he imagined a time in the distant past when our ancestors could sail each night across the ocean in boats to meet the setting moon and clamber onto its surface using ladders. As the moon drifted farther away over the years, there came a night when the moon lovers had to make a choice between becoming trapped on the moon forever or returning to Earth. This surprising and, in the hands of Calvino, strangely romantic phenomenon has its explanation in the abstract concept of invariance and the deep connection between invariance and the conservation of physical quantities. It is difficult to overstate the importance of the idea of invariance in modern science. At the heart of physics is the desire to produce an intellectual framework that is universal and in which the laws are never a matter of opinion. As physicists, we aim to uncover the invariant properties of the universe because, as Noether well knew, these lead us to real and tangible insights. Identifying the invariant properties is far from easy, however, because nature's underlying simplicity and beauty are often hidden. Nowhere in science is this truer than in modern particle physics. Particle physics is the study of the subatomic world, the quest for the fundamental building blocks of the universe and the forces of nature that stick them together. We have already met one of the fundamental forces, electromagnetism. Understanding it led us to an explanation for the nature of light that has launched us on the road to relativity. In the subatomic world, there are two other forces of nature that hold sway. The strong nuclear force sticks the atomic nucleus together at the heart of the atom, and the weak nuclear force allows stars to shine and is responsible for certain types of radioactive decay. The use of radiocarbon dating to measure the age of things, for example, relies on the weak nuclear force. The fourth force is gravity, the most familiar perhaps, but by far the weakest. Our best theory of gravity today is still Einstein's general theory of relativity, and, as we shall see in the final chapter, it is a theory of space and time. These four forces act between just 12 fundamental particles to build everything in the world we can see, including the sun, moon, and stars, all the planets in our solar system, and indeed our own bodies. This all constitutes an astonishing simplification of what at first glance appears to be an almost infinitely complicated universe. Glance out of your window. You may be faced with the distorted reflections of a city as the afternoon light scatters off sheets of steel and glass, or black and white cattle grazing in neatly fenced green fields. But whether cityscape or farmland, the most astonishing thing about practically every window view in the world is the evidence of human intervention. Our civilization is all-pervasive, and yet 21st century physics tells us that, at its heart, it is all a mathematical dance involving a handful of subatomic particles organized by only four forces of nature over 13.7 billion years. The complexity of human brains and the products of the powerful synthesis between consciousness and dexterous skill that we glimpse outside our windows mask the underlying simplicity and elegance of nature. The scientist's task is to hunt for those properties that act as a Rosetta Stone to allow us to decipher the language of nature and reveal its beauty. The tool that allows us to search for and exploit these properties of nature is mathematics. In itself, this is a sentence that throws up deep questions, and entire books have been written attempting to advance plausible reasons as to why it may be so. Quoting Eugene Wigner again, "The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve." Perhaps we will never understand the true nature of the relationship between mathematics and nature, but history has shown that mathematics allows us to organize our thinking in a way that proves to be a reliable guide to a deeper understanding. As we have been at pains to emphasize, to proceed in this spirit, physicists write down equations, and equations do nothing more than express relationships between different real-world things. An example of an equation is speed equals distance divided by time, which we met in the last chapter when we were discussing light clocks. In symbols, V equals X divided by T, where V is the speed, X is the distance travelled, and T is the time taken to travel the distance X. Very simply, recall that if you travel 60 miles in 1 hour, then you have travelled at a speed of 60 miles per hour. Now, the most interesting equations will be those that are capable of furnishing a description of nature that is agreed upon by everyone. That is, they should deal only in invariant quantities. We could all then agree on what we are measuring, irrespective of our perspective in the universe. According to common sense, the distance between any two points in space is such an invariant quantity. And pre-Einstein, it was. But we saw in the previous chapter that it is no such thing. Remember, common sense is not always reliable. Similarly, the passage of time has become a subjective thing, and it varies depending on how fast clocks are moving relative to each other. Einstein has upset the order of things, and we cannot even rely on distance and time to build a reliable picture of the universe. From the point of view of a physicist looking for the deep laws of nature, the equation V equals X divided by T is therefore of no fundamental use because it does not express a relationship between invariant quantities. By undermining space and time, we have shaken the very foundations of physics. What then are we to do? One option is to try and re-establish order by making a conjecture. Conjecture is a fancy word for guess, and scientists do it all the time. There are no prizes for how smart we are in figuring out the underlying theory, A successful, educated guess will do just fine, so long as it agrees with experiment. The conjecture is radical. Space and time can be merged into a single entity that we call space-time, and distances in space-time are invariant. This is a bold assertion, and its content will become clearer as we go. When you think about it for a moment, it is perhaps less bold than it seems at first sight. If we are to lose the age-old certainties of absolute, unvarying distances in space, and the unchanging tick-tock of time as the great clock in the sky marks the passing of the years, then maybe the only thing to do is to search for some kind of unification of the two seemingly separate concepts. Therefore, our immediate challenge is to search for a new measure of distance in space-time that does not change depending on how we move around relative to each other. We will need to tread carefully to understand how the space-time synthesis works. But what exactly does it mean to search for a distance in space-time? Suppose I get out of bed at 7 a.m. and finish my breakfast at 8 a.m. The following statements are true, given what we know from experiment. 1. I may measure the distance in space from my bed to my kitchen to be 10 meters, but someone whizzing by at high speed will measure a different distance. 2. My watch indicates that I took 1 hour to eat breakfast, but the high-speed observer will record a different time. Our conjecture is that the distance in space-time between my getting out of bed and my finishing breakfast is something we can all agree upon, i.e., it is invariant. The existence of this consensus is crucial because we want to build up a set of natural laws using only this type of object. Of course, we just guessed that this might be how things are, and we certainly haven't proven anything yet. We haven't even decided how to calculate distances in space-time. But to proceed further, we must first explain what is meant by the second of our three key words, causality. Causality is another seemingly obvious concept, whose application will have profound consequences. It is simply the requirement that cause and effect are so important that their order cannot be reversed. Your mother caused your birth, and no self-consistent picture of space and time should allow you to be born before your mother. To construct a theory of the universe in which you could be born first would be nonsense and lead to contradictions. When put in these terms, nobody could argue with the requirement of causality. It is worth reflecting, however, that humans seem capable of ignoring it on a daily basis. Take prophecy, for example. Figures like Nostradamus are revered to this day for allegedly being able to see events that happen in the future, either in dreams or some other mystical trance-like state. In other words, events that happened centuries after Nostradamus's death were visible in his lifetime, at least to him. Nostradamus died in 1566, but he is credited with observing the Great Fire of London in 1666, the rise of Napoleon and Hitler, the September the 11th, 2001 attacks on the United States, and our own personal favourite, the rise of the Antichrist in Russia in 1999. The Antichrist hasn't appeared yet, but perhaps he or she is still rising, and if he or she does appear before this book is published, then we stand corrected. Putting amusing drivel aside, we need to introduce some important terminology. Nostradamus's death was an event, as were the birth of Adolf Hitler and the Great Fire of London. For Nostradamus to observe an event such as the Great Fire that happened after his death would require the ordering of the two events to be reversed. To say this explicitly is almost a tautology. Nostradamus died before the Great Fire, and therefore he could not have observed it. To observe it, the event that is the Great Fire must have been available for viewing before the event that is Nostradamus's death, and therefore the order of the events must have been reversed. There is an important subtlety. Nostradamus could have caused the Great Fire. We could imagine that he left a sum of money in a bank account that encouraged someone to light a fire in Pudding Lane shortly after midnight on September the 2nd, 1666. This would establish a causal link between the events associated with the life and death of Nostradamus and the events associated with the Great Fire of London. As we shall see later, it is in fact only the ordering of such connected events, called causally connected events, that cannot be reversed. Cause and effect are sacred in Einstein's universe. Other events occur far enough away from each other in space and time that they could not have any possible influence on each other. Remarkably, the ordering of these can be reversed. Einstein's theory exploits a loophole that allows the order of events to be switched, provided that doing so makes absolutely no difference to the workings of the universe. We shall explain what we mean by far enough away later on. For now, we have introduced the concept of causality as an axiom that we shall use to build our theory of space-time. The success of the theory in predicting the outcome of experiments will of course be the ultimate arbiter. As an aside, Nostradamus did get one prediction right. While suffering from a particularly acute bout of gout, he apparently told his secretary, "You will not find me alive at sunrise." The next morning, he was found dead on the floor. What has causality got to do with space-time, and in particular, distances in space-time? Well, we will soon discover that insisting on a causal universe constrains the structure of space-time to such an extent that we are left with no choice in the matter. There will be only one way in which we can merge space and time together to manufacture space-time while simultaneously preserving the causal order of things. Any other way would violate causality and allow us to do fantastical things like going back in time to prevent our own birth, or, in Nostradamus's case, perhaps avoiding a lifestyle that made him susceptible to gout. Time now to return to the challenge of developing the concept of distance in space-time. To get warmed up, we will set time to one side for the moment and think about the idea of distance in ordinary three-dimensional space, a concept with which we are all familiar. Suppose we try to measure the shortest distance between two cities on a flat map of the Earth. As will be very familiar to anyone who has flown on a long-haul flight and watched her progress on the map on the aircraft entertainment system, the shortest distance between any two points on the Earth's surface appears as a curve. This line is known as a great circle. The curved nature of the Earth's surface is also the reason why, on some flat maps, Greenland looks much bigger than Australia, when in reality it is much smaller. The message is clear. Straight lines represent the shortest distance between two points only in flat space. The geometry of flat space is often called Euclidean geometry. What Euclid didn't know at the time, however, and in fact it did not become clear until the 19th century, was that his geometry of flat space is only a specific example of a whole family of different possible geometries, each of which are mathematically consistent, and some of which can be used to describe nature. A very good example is the surface of the Earth, which is curved and therefore described using a geometry that is non-Euclidean. Specifically, the shortest distance between two points is not a Euclidean straight line. There are other familiar Euclidean properties that are not obeyed on the surface of the Earth. For example, the interior angles of a triangle no longer add up to 180 degrees, and lines that are parallel and point north-south at the equator cross at the poles. If Euclid is no use anymore, we need to figure out how to calculate distances in a curved space, such as on the Earth's surface. One way would be to work directly with a globe and measure out the distances using a piece of string. Now we would be correctly accounting for the curvature of the Earth. An airline pilot could stretch a piece of string between two cities on the globe, measure its length with a ruler, and then simply multiply the answer by the ratio in size of the globe and the Earth. But maybe we don't have a globe on hand, or maybe we need to write the computer software that helps airplanes navigate. In either case, we need to do better than a piece of string and figure out an equation that tells us the distance between any two points on the Earth's surface, given only their latitude and longitude, and the shape and size of the Earth. Such an equation is not too hard to find, and if you know a little mathematics, you might even try to find it. We don't need to express it here, but the point is that an equation exists, and it hasn't got much to do with the Euclidean geometry of a flat tabletop. It does, however, allow one to calculate the shortest distance between two points on a sphere, in much the same way that Pythagoras's theorem is a recipe for calculating the shortest distance between two points, the hypotenuse, on a tabletop, if we know the distance from one corner as measured along the edges of the table. Since straight lines belong in the domain of Euclid, we shall introduce a new term for the shortest distance between two points that applies whether the space is curved or flat. This line is called a geodesic. A great circle is a geodesic on the surface of the earth, and a straight line is a geodesic in flat space. So much for distances in three-dimensional space. Now we must decide how to measure distances in space-time. So let's go ahead and complicate matters by adding time into the mix. We already introduced the concepts we will need when we thought about getting out of bed and finishing breakfast in the kitchen. There is no problem in saying that the distance in space between the bed and the kitchen is 10 meters. We could also say, although it sounds rather strange, that the distance in time between getting out of bed and finishing breakfast is 1 hour. This is not how we naturally think about time, because we are not used to describing it in the language of geometry. We would rather say, 1 hour passed between my getting out of bed and finishing my breakfast. In the same way, we would not normally say, 10 meters have passed since I got out of bed and sat down in the kitchen. Space is space, and time is time, and never the twain shall be intermingled. But we have set ourselves the task of trying to merge space and time together, because we suspect that this is the only way to rebuild things in a way that fits with Maxwell and Einstein. So let us proceed and see where it leads us. If you are not a scientist, then this may be the most difficult part of the book so far, because we are operating in a purely abstract fashion. The capacity for abstract thought is what gives science its power, but also perhaps gives it a reputation as being difficult, because it is not a faculty we generally need too much in everyday life. We have already encountered a difficult abstract concept in the form of the electric and magnetic fields. And in fact, the abstraction needed to merge space and time together is probably less challenging than that. What we are doing implicitly in speaking of the distance in time is treating time as an additional dimension. We are used to the phrase 3D, as in three-dimensional, referring to the fact that space has three dimensions, up and down, left and right, forward and backward. When we try to add time into the framework so that we can define distances in space-time, we are in effect creating a four-dimensional space. To be sure, the time dimension behaves differently than the space dimensions. We have complete freedom of movement in space, whereas we go only one way in time, and time doesn't feel anything like space. But that need not be an insurmountable hurdle. Thinking of time as just another dimension is the abstract leap we have to take. The trick, if it sounds too confusing, is to imagine how you might feel if you were a creature that could only ever move forward, backward, left and right. You have never experienced up and down. You live in a flat world. If someone asked you to imagine a third dimension, your flat mind would not be able to grasp it. But if you had a mathematical bent, you might be happy to accept the possibility. And, in any case, you could still do the maths, even if you couldn't picture the mysterious extra dimension in your mind's eye. Likewise, for human beings and four-dimensional space, it should become more natural to think of time as just another dimension as our story unfolds. If there is one thing we try to teach our students when they first arrive at the University of Manchester, ready to learn to be physicists, it is that everyone gets confused and stuck. Very few people understand difficult concepts the first time they encounter them, and the way to a deeper understanding is to move forward with small steps. In the words of Douglas Adams, don't panic. Let us continue in a gentler vein for a moment by noticing something very simple. Things happen. We wake up. We make breakfast. We eat breakfast, and so on. We'll call the occurrence of a thing an event in space-time. We can uniquely describe an event in space-time by four numbers, three spatial coordinates describing where it happened, and a time coordinate describing when it happened. Spatial coordinates can be specified using any old measuring system. For example, longitude, latitude, and altitude will do if the event is occurring in the vicinity of the Earth. So your coordinates in bed might be 53 degrees 28 minutes north, 2 degrees 13 minutes west, and 38 meters above sea level. Your time coordinates are specified using a clock. Because time is not universal, we'll have to say whose clock in order to be unambiguous. And might be 7 a.m. GMT when your alarm goes off and you wake up. So we have four numbers that uniquely locate any event in space-time. Notice that there is nothing special about the particular choice of coordinates. In fact, these particular coordinates are measured relative to a line passing through Greenwich in London, England. This convention was agreed upon in October 1884 by 25 nations, with the only dissenting voice being San Domingo. France abstained. It is a very important concept that the choice of coordinates should make absolutely no difference. Let's take the moment when I wake up in bed as our first event in space-time. The second event could be the event that marks the end of breakfast. We have said that the spatial distance between the two events is 10 meters, and the distance in time is 1 hour. To be unambiguous, we'd need to say something like, I measured the distance between my bed and my breakfast table using a tape measure whose ends were stretched directly from bed to table. And I measured the time interval using my bedside clock and the clock sitting in my kitchen. Don't forget that we already know that these two distances in space and in time are not universally agreed upon. Someone flying past your house in an aircraft would say that your clock runs slow and the distance between your bed and your breakfast table shrinks. Our aim is to find a distance in space-time upon which everyone agrees. The million-dollar question is then, how do we take the 10 meters and the 1 hour to construct an invariant distance in space-time? We need to tread carefully, and, just like in the case of distances on the Earth's surface, we shall not assume Euclidean geometry. If we are to compute distances in space-time, then we have an immediate problem to resolve. If distance in space is measured in meters and distance in time in seconds, how can we even begin to contemplate combining the two? It is like adding apples and oranges, because they are not the same type of quantity. We can, however, convert distances into times and vice versa if we use the equation we met earlier, v equals x divided by t. With a minuscule bit of algebra, we can write time t equals x divided by v, or distance x equals vt. In other words, distance and time can be interchanged using something that has the currency of a speed. Let us therefore introduce a calibrating speed, call it c. We can then measure time in meters, provided we take any time interval and multiply it by our calibrating speed. At this point in our reasoning, c really can be any old speed, and we have not committed ourselves at all as to its actual value. Actually, this trick of interchanging time and distance is very common in astronomy, where the distance to stars and galaxies is often measured in light years, which is the distance light travels in 1 year. This doesn't seem so strange because we are used to it, but it really is a distance measured in years, which is a unit of time. In the astronomy case, the calibrating speed is the speed of light. This is progress. We now have time and distance intervals in the same currency. For example, they could both be given in meters, or miles, or light years, or whatever. Imagine two events in space-time. They are a distance x apart in space and a distance ct apart in time. We can represent the distance x as the base of a right-angled triangle and ct as the height of the triangle. Our goal is to figure out the length of the hypotenuse, s, in terms of x and ct. Making contact with our earlier example, x equals 10 meters is the distance in space from bed to kitchen table, and t equals 1 hour is the distance in time. So far, since c was arbitrary, ct can be anything, and we appear to be treading water. We shall press onward nonetheless. We have to decide on a means of measuring the length of the hypotenuse. the distance between two events in space-time. Should we choose Euclidean space, in which case we can use Pythagoras's theorem, or something more complicated? Perhaps our space should be curved like the surface of the Earth, or maybe some other more complicated shape. There are, in fact, an infinite number of ways that we might imagine calculating distances. We'll proceed in the way that physicists often do, and we will make a guess. Our guess will be guided by a very important and useful principle called Occam's razor, named after the English thinker William of Occam, who lived at the turn of the 14th century. The idea is simple to state, but surprisingly difficult to implement in everyday life. It might be summarized as, don't overcomplicate things. Occam stated it as, plurality must never be posited without necessity. Which does beg the question, why didn't he pay more attention to his own rule when constructing sentences? However it is stated, Occam's razor is very powerful, even brutal, when applied to reasoning about the natural world. It really says that the simplest hypothesis should be tried first, and only if this fails should we add complication bit by bit until the hypothesis fits the experimental evidence. In our case, the simplest way to construct a distance is to assume that at least the space part of our space-time should be Euclidean. In other words, space is flat. This means that the familiar way of working out the distance in space between objects in the room in which we are seated reading this book is carried over into our new framework intact. What could be simpler? The question, then, is how we should add time. Another simplifying assumption is that our space-time is unchanging and the same everywhere. These are important assumptions. In fact, Einstein did eventually relax them, and doing so allowed him to contemplate the mind and space-bending possibility that space-time could be constantly changed by the presence of matter and energy. It led to his general theory of relativity, which is to this day our best theory of gravity. We will meet general relativity in the final chapter, but for the moment, we can ignore all these twists and turns. Once we follow Occam and make these two simplifying assumptions, we are left with only two possible choices as to how to calculate distances in space-time. The length of the hypotenuse must be either s squared equals c squared t squared plus x squared, or s squared equals c squared t squared minus x squared. There is no other option. Although we did not prove it, our assumption that space-time should be unchanging and the same everywhere leads to only these two possibilities, and we must pick either the plus sign or the minus sign. Of course, proof or no proof, we can be pragmatic and see what happens when we try each one on for size. Flipping the sign means that the mathematics is not much of an extension over the by now familiar equation of Pythagoras. Our task is to figure out whether we should stick with the plus sign version of Pythagoras or shift to the minus sign version of the distance equation. This may look at first sight to be a rather odd thing to investigate. What possible reason could there be for even considering Pythagoras with a minus sign? But that is not the right way to think about things. The formula for distances on a sphere looks nothing like Pythagoras either, so all we are doing is entertaining the idea that space-time might not be flat in the sense of Euclid. Indeed, since the minus sign version is the only option other than the plus sign version, given our assumptions, we have no logical reason to throw it out at this stage. We should therefore keep it and investigate the consequences. If neither the plus nor the minus sign versions do the job, and we fail in constructing a workable distance measure in space-time, then we must go back to the drawing board. We are now about to plunge into a very elegant but perhaps tricky piece of reasoning. We will stick to our promise of using nothing more complicated than Pythagoras, but you might find that you need to listen to it twice. It should be worth it, because if you follow closely, you might experience a feeling described by biologist Edward O. Wilson as the Ionian enchantment. It derives from the work of Thales of Miletus, who is credited by Aristotle 2 centuries later as laying the foundations of the physical sciences in Ionia in the 6th century BCE. This poetic term describes the belief that the complexity of the world can be explained by a small number of simple natural laws, Because at its heart it is orderly and simple, we are reminded of Wigner's essay. The scientist's job is to strip away the complexity we see around us and to uncover this underlying simplicity. When the process works out and the simplicity and unity of the world are revealed, we experience the Ionian enchantment. Imagine for a moment cradling a snowflake in the palm of your hand. It is an elegant and beautiful structure, possessed of a jagged crystalline symmetry. No two snowflakes are alike, and at first sight, this chaotic state of affairs seems to defy a simple explanation. Science has taught us that the apparent complexity of snowflakes hides an exquisite underlying simplicity. Each is a configuration of billions of molecules of water, H2O. There is nothing more to a snowflake than that, and yet an overwhelming complex of structure and form emerges when those H2O molecules get together in the atmosphere of our planet on a cold winter's night. To settle the question of the plus or minus sign, we need to turn our attention to causality. Let us first suppose that Pythagoras's is the right equation for distances in space-time, i.e. s squared equals c squared t squared plus x squared. Yet again, we return to our two events, waking up in bed at 7 a.m. and finishing breakfast in the kitchen at 8 a.m. We'll do something that may send shivers up your spine, as you remember sitting in mathematics classes at school and gazing out of the window across the football fields, pristine and inviting in the spring afternoon sunlight. Let the waking up event be called O, and the finishing breakfast event be called A. We do this purely for reasons of brevity, without wishing to don tweed and cover ourselves in chalk dust. We know that the spatial distance between O and A is x equals 10 meters, and the distance in time between the two events is t equals 1 hour, where x and t are measured by me. We haven't decided what c is yet, but when we do, we will know ct, and we can then go ahead and use the distance equation to calculate s, the distance in space-time between events O and A. Our hypothesis is that while x and t can and will be different if they are measured by someone flying past at close to the speed of light, the distance s will stay the same. In other words, x and t can and will change, but they must change in such a way that s never changes. To risk overemphasizing the point, we want to remind you that our goal is always to build the laws of physics using invariant objects in space-time, and the distance s is just such an object. If that sounds too abstract, then we can say it again, but this time using less mathematically fancy language. Nature's rules must express relationships between real things, and those things live in space-time. A thing living in space-time is akin to an object sitting in a room. Space-time, or the room, is the arena in which the thing lives. The nature of real things is not a matter of opinion, and in that sense, we say they are invariant. A three-dimensional example of something that is not an invariant might be the flickering shadow of an object sitting in a room illuminated by a warming fire. Clearly, the shadow varies depending on how the fire is burning and where the fire is, but we are never in any doubt that a real, unvarying object is responsible for it. Using space-time, our plan is to lift physics out of the shadows and hunt down relationships between real objects. The fact that two different observers can disagree on the values of x and t, provided s is the same, has a very important consequence, which can be visualized quite simply. Imagine a circle in space-time of radius s that is centered on a point O, which represents the waking up event. Because we are, for the moment, using the Pythagorean form of the distance equation, every point on the circumference of the circle is the same distance s away from O. This is a pretty obvious statement. The distance s is the radius of the circle. Points outside the circle are farther away from O, while points inside are closer to O. But our hypothesis is that S is the distance in space-time between events O and A. In other words, the event A could lie anywhere on the circumference of the circle and still be a distance s in space-time from O. At what point on the circle should event A lie? That depends on who is measuring x and t. For me in the house, we know exactly where it should be, since x equals 10 meters and t equals 1 hour. Since t is positive, we are to picture A as lying on the upper half of the circle centered on O. That is, it lies in the future of O.